This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran warns the EU against taking hasty political measures based on false accusations, promising reciprocal action in response to such measures. The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and non-OPEC producers announced a major output cut, defying US pressure to keep oil production high. Also in the headlines, thousands of Hungarians take to the streets in the capital Budapest in support of teachers fighting for higher wages amid the country's soaring inflation. Welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran has warned the European Union against taking hasty political measures based on unfounded accusations to embolden rioters and terrorists targeting Iranian people. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell. His statements came a day after the bloc said it was mulling restrictive measures against Tehran in the wake of recent riots. Iran's top diplomat said Tehran respects people's right to hold peaceful protests, but will take firm legal measures against rioters and terrorists. For his part, Borrell admitted that rioting and terrorism are different from peaceful protests that need an appropriate response. He added that the bloc does not intend to cause problems in its relations with the Islamic Republic. Riots erupted after a young woman died at a hospital after being taken by police. A thorough investigation is underway to ascertain the exact cause of her death. Days of unrest in Iran over the death of Mahsa Amini has started to draw condemnation from many Iranians. In Tehran, a counter-protest was staged to denounce the violence. Yusuf Jalali has more.
This rally is a response to more than 2 weeks of violent protests in Iran over the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who collapsed at a police station and later died at a hospital. Here, demonstrators denounced street violence, saying there are peaceful ways to protest.
Today, we gather to protect our religion and to voice our support for the Islamic Republic.
Islam tries to promote these three slogans, woman, chastity and honor. So we came here to condemn those who seek to change our Islamic ideals.
The chaos began in mid-September, with protesters calling on the police to explain Mahsa's death. Over the past days, students in universities and schools have also joined the protests. On Monday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, shared his sympathies over the death of Mahsa Amini, while condemning the unrest. The West, and on top of it the U.S., have made supportive comments on the protests in Iran, something which these people call tongue-in-cheek remarks, made to fuel the turmoil in the country.
I should tell those who take to the streets and vandalize public properties that they are serving the interests of the U.S. These days, the American officials have been trying to fuel the flame of violence to get to their vicious goals in our country.
22-year-old Mahsa was an Iranian Kurd from the city of Saqqez in Kurdistan province. On September 13th, she was on a trip to Tehran with her family when she was taken by the police over her non-compliance with the Islamic dress code. CCTV footage released by police showed that she passed out at the police station for what was later revealed to be a heart attack. 3 days later, she died in hospital.
These people believe protesters are playing into the hands of Iran's enemies. Here, they demand an immediate end to the chaos and violence. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
British police have released images of anti-Iran protesters who were present at a violent riot outside Iran's London embassy, which saw police officers over there wounded and the building vandalized. Amid the manhunt, Robert Carter highlights the continued threat Western-based anti-Iran dissident groups pose on Britain's streets.
British police have released images of individuals they want to identify in connection with the recent anti-Iran riots opposite Iran's embassy in London. The London Metropolitan Police have already admitted that five officers were seriously injured during clashes with demonstrators on September the 25th. The protesters claimed to support Iranian woman Marza Amini, who collapsed at a police station in Tehran on September the 16th. A spokesperson for the Met said,
"We won't tolerate members of the public or officers who are doing all they can to maintain and regain order being injured in any circumstances. And we are now doing everything we can to make sure those who committed the violent offences are brought to justice."
Police are now guarding the embassy and consulate building, but other sites remain fearful of future attacks too. The Islamic Centre of England in Maida Vale was also targeted in the recent riots.
There's been so many cases where these so-called Iranians, these, you know, pro-Iranians have come and they've ripped off women's hijabs and they've beat up little girls and they've smashed in people's heads. It's just ridiculous.
The recent protests saw a hodgepodge of rival ideologies and dissident groups banding together. Many of these groups have a history of conducting violent attacks against Iranian expats living in the West. We witnessed supporters of the anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO, and former Shah dictatorship supporters verbally and physically assaulting Iranians attempting to vote in London back in June 2021.
I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well, and it hit my trainer, bit of it. And then they're calling names. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously you couldn't understand Farsi. He was telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now.
Calm has returned to London streets for the time being. However, many of the dissident groups which took part in the recent riots remain active and at large, acting as opportunists, willing to jump on any opportunity to harass ordinary Iranian expats and seemingly anyone else who stands in their way. Robert Carter, London.
For nearly a decade, Albania has been accommodating members of the MKO, an anti-Iran terror group, behind the killing of thousands of Iranian civilians. Now the Balkan country has acknowledged that the group should not engage in any political activity on its soil. The Albanian Minister of Infrastructure and Energy claims her country is hosting the MKO on humanitarian grounds. Belinda Beluka says the group is not allowed to do any activity beyond what it had agreed with the Albanian government. The MKO has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Despite its decades-long acts of terror, the EU and the US have dropped the group from their list of foreign terrorist organizations. The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, and its Russian-led allies have announced a big cut in oil production from the coming November, defying U.S. pressure. During a meeting in Vienna, the 23 countries, together known as OPEC Plus, agreed to reduce the output by 2 million barrels per day to boost a crude market already reeling from the global economic crisis. And that's over 2% of the global oil production and comes amid soaring energy prices. The move prompted a blistering reaction from the White House. In a statement, Washington expressed disappointment over what it called short-sighted decision by the cartel. It said the president would consult with the Congress to reduce OPEC's control over energy prices. The U.S. already warned the cartel against the crippling consequences of the measure for the world economy. Soaring energy prices in Italy continue to bite. The Italian Retailers Association has announced that hundreds of thousands of firms are at the risk of closure next year as a recession looms on the country's economic horizon.
On Wednesday, Italy's largest retailers association, Confcommercio, warned that over 120,000 small businesses risk shutting down in the first half of 2023. The association said firms are squeezed by the cost of living and skyrocketing energy prices. The president of Confcommercio, Carlo Sangalli, urged the government to do more to shield small and medium entrepreneurs, as the situation for many is now very critical.
There is the risk of a high number of business closures in the coming 9 months. Some small firms will simply find it more convenient to suspend their activity rather than losing 200 to 300 euros a day. Having said that, Italy will soon face a mild recession, which frankly is not as worrying as the media depict it.
Last month, Italy's outgoing government approved an aid package worth some 14 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. The measure came on top of over 50 billion euros already budgeted since January to soften the energy crisis in the country. However, the aid seems to be insufficient as an increasing number of businesses are struggling to stay afloat.
Everything costs at least 20% more. Energy prices keep soaring and it is very hard to keep going. We need help. The government must do something.
I cannot afford paying expenses for my family. I have four dependent children. They're all unemployed. Bills keep going up. How do we cope?
According to Confcommercio, more than 370,000 jobs are at risk as a result of the energy crisis. Meanwhile, energy giant Eni announced that gas supplies to Italy from Russia have resumed after 4 days. Russia's state-controlled Gazprom cut off gas supplies to Italy on Saturday, citing a problem linked to regulatory changes in Austria. Italy's national energy regulator, ARERA, warned last week that prices would climb by almost 60% by the end of the year, but experts argue that its estimate was optimistic. Bills have risen by 93% in Italy over the past 2 years, and the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, together with the damage recently sustained by Nord Stream pipelines, is likely to push costs even higher. Max Civili, Rome.
Thousands of Hungarians have taken to the streets in the capital Budapest, blocking a major bridge in support of teachers fighting for higher wages. At least 10,000 Hungarian students, teachers and parents took part in the Wednesday protest. This came after Hungarian teachers launched a campaign calling for civil disobedience to demand higher wages and the right to strike. The protest also followed a call by trade unions for a nationwide teacher strike after the government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban imposed restrictions on strike action. Hungary's economy is heading into a recession next year, with inflation in double digits and the national currency registering successive record lows versus the euro. There seems to be no end in sight to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Regime forces have killed one more Palestinian during a raid on the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 21-year-old Alaa Zaghal was shot in the head by Israeli troops. The ministry says at least two others were also injured during the Israeli operation near the city of Nablus. Israel has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks across the occupied territories this year so far. Turning elsewhere now, South Korea and Japan say the North has fired two short-range ballistic missiles amid escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula. According to the South Korean military, the missiles were fired from Pyongyang towards the country's east coast and in the direction of Japan. This is North Korea's sixth missile launch in 12 days and the first since it fired an intermediate-range missile over Japan. North Korea's foreign ministry said Thursday's recent missile launches were, quote, counteraction measures against joint military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. It's added that the joint drills escalate military tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang considers such moves as rehearsals for an invasion. It accuses the U.S. and its regional allies of threatening it with war games and military buildup. 7 years ago, on October the 3rd, U.S. airstrikes destroyed the trauma hospital run by Doctors Without Borders in Afghanistan's city of Kunduz. 42 people were killed in the attack, including patients, caretakers, and hospital staff. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Back on October 3, 2015, this Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz was reduced to rubble after being hit by a U.S. deadly airstrike. 211 shells were fired in the strike, lasting almost 1 hour. The charity hospital later announced that 42 civilians, including staffers and patients, were killed, and dozens of others were wounded.
Throughout the NATO coalition presence in Afghanistan, there were a lot of blind airstrikes and rights violations against Afghan civilians, especially by American air forces. The 2015 attack on Kunduz Charity Hospital was one of those atrocities and the biggest of its kind. As I remember, it was so deadly and devastating. Hospitals in war zones are protected under the Fourth Geneva Convention, and attacks on them should be tried as a war crime.
After initially denying the building being targeted, the U.S. eventually claimed responsibility for the airstrikes, justifying that it had been a serious and tragic mistake.
Independently and impartially.
The MSF called it a breach of international humanitarian law and a war crime, demanding for an independent probe. But an independent investigation or trial has never been conducted against the U.S. forces' atrocities.
The MSF and rights bodies believe that the U.S. deadly air raid on Charity Hospital could be prosecuted as a war crime, but the international courts and bodies failed to conduct a trial because they are controlled by arrogant powers. They are funded by those countries and obey them. Besides, the U.S. has never agreed to turn any of their service members over to an outside judicial body. As a result, the case of the Kunduz attack was shot by Washington with a mere discipline of some American personnel, and no one was criminally charged.
Throughout the two-decade U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, there had been more than 13,000 airstrikes conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed more than 4,000 people, including women and children. The U.S. airstrike on the Charity Hospital in Kunduz is one of the many instances of American forces' atrocities on Afghan soil. People here say the U.S. should be held accountable for crimes it has committed in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The fabricated regime of Israel is a brutal European settler colony that has been targeting Palestinians and is stealing their land since its inception. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Hamid Dabashi, author, in an article published under the heading Gaza on Screen: How Palestinian Truth Implicates All of Humanity. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Telling you the truth, the Israeli regime military or propaganda, from which major U.S. and European media outlets, including the BBC and New York Times, take their cues, or countless Palestinian filmmakers transforming the facts of their experiences into artistic truth? Where do sublime works of art stand vis-a-vis the relentless barrage of falsehoods and propaganda that conquerors habitually spin to justify and camouflage their barbarians? What is a Ghassan Kanafani novella, a Mona Hatoum artwork, a Mahmoud Darwish poem, or an Ilya Soleiman film next to Israeli regime tanks, fighter jets, smart bombs, assassination squads, nuclear submarines, or sharpshooters? When an empire is vast and variegated like the U.S., it can afford both military thuggery around the globe and ingenious filmmakers such as Stanley Kubrick, Oliver Stone, or the Hughes brothers to dismantle the lies of those conquests. When a settler colony like the fabricated regime of Israel is too small to afford such complexities, it just bombs, maims, and murders, while its propaganda machinery does the camouflaging in manipulated news coverage. In the Palestinian case, there is no military to speak of. What they have on their side are facts and truth, truth that would have gone unheard were it not for the Palestinian poets, journalists, scholars, artists, novelists, and filmmakers. But isn't this comparing apples and oranges? The military might of a settler colony to the works of art that those under its occupation produce? But that amounts to asymmetrical warfare. Palestinians have no military, air force, or navy. The Zionists do. Palestinians do not receive billions of dollars in military aid from the U.S. and Europe. The Zionists do. Palestinians wage only a form of guerrilla warfare imposed on them by cruel fate. Militarily, Palestine is no match for the fake regime of Israel, but artistically, aesthetically, morally, and imaginatively, the Zionist regime is no match for Palestine. Take the most recent Zionist regime atrocities in Gaza earlier this month. A relentless blockade and repeated invasions of the Gaza Strip culminated in yet another war of aggression that terrorized Palestinians, destroyed their homes, and denied them their livelihoods. What is the function of Palestinian filmmakers in times of such Israeli terror? The dominant US and UK media consider themselves to be truly objective and fair when they pronounce that there are two sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as they claim. But there are not two sides of the Zionist regime's systematic, purposeful, and relentless occupation and theft of Palestine and the murder of Palestinians. There is only one truth, which has no sides. The fabricated regime of Israel is a brutal European settler colony that has been targeting Palestinians and stealing their land since its inception. A key element of this resistance has been cinema. with around 2 million inhabitants on some 365 square kilometers, Gaza is among the most densely populated places in the world. Many observers call it the largest open-air prison. The fabricated regime of Israel has systematically used the territory to test its most recent weaponry, causing death, destruction, and despair to Palestinian civilians. The choice of Gaza as the theme of a film festival was emblematic of the larger Palestinian question in light of their status as victims of European colonial conquest. In Gaza's Metaphor, a 2016 collection edited by Dina Matar and Helga Tauli-Suri, insightful essays describe how Gaza has become a metaphor for the larger Palestinian struggle. It is a floating signifier, open-air prison, terror, resistance, occupation, siege, trauma. But we should not be trapped inside such metaphors, rather we must see through them. Their simple truths reference the disposition of a nation and its landscape of history and humanity. Palestinian art and cinema receive, recast, and reassert that history and humanity. Gaza is not a metaphor for cruel world. Gaza is that world. The battle the Israelis have lost is not a battle between two narratives. It is a battle between truth and charlatanism. More specifically, it is between the aesthetic sublimation of Palestinian truth through visual and performing arts and the banal propaganda administered by the Zionist regime spin doctors. For example, after Israeli regime forces killed more than a dozen children in their latest operation, the Zionist propaganda initially alleged Islamic Jihad was to blame for most of its deaths. There is no aesthetic sublimation of the falsehoods of Zionism, for it is bereft of any truth to raise the aesthetic sublimation. It has lost the uneven battle between the Zionist regime lies and Palestinian truth. Palestinian and other journalists, Arabs and non-Arabs, Muslims and non-Muslims, have worked tirelessly to expose these lies and report the bare facts. Gaza, the names and faces of the 17 Palestinian children killed in Israel's onslaught, reads one recent Middle East Eye headline. At least 49 Palestinians were killed and more than 360 wounded as Israeli airstrikes rained down on the besieged strip over 3 days. There is no corporate or mainstream monopoly over the news anymore. Pro-Israel outlets such as the BBC and New York Times are just a click away from countless other outlets that are doing what those institutions have failed to do. But the facts that journalists expose never speak for themselves, they must yield to the imaginative power of the arts to find a universal tongue that the world understands best. Gaza on screen is no mere corrective lens for Zionist, European, and American propaganda. It is a perfect mirror of a heroic defiance of cruel fate. In the face of that mirror, we cannot be fatalistic, for we are witnessing a Palestinian truth that implicates the rest of humanity, and the Israelis in particular, should they ever dare to face that mirror.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us again on this episode of Muslim Lady. Here in the studio, I am joined with our special guest and my darling sister, Sister Razia Shamili, and we've been talking about the interesting topic of hijab. Trust me, it's much more interesting than you can imagine. Stay with us.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very eager to see what we're going to talk about today, inshallah.
So on the previous episode, we talked about how to motivate young women to practice the hijab. And how to reintroduce it to them as what it actually is, which mm-hmm. is a form of self-discipline mm-hmm. and a value for which they can stand up and fight. And I think that's just such a magnificent way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And how hijab is not gender inclusive. Mm-hmm. It's for both men and women. We both have different types of hijab because it stems from... genderless value, which is haya, mm-hmm. modesty, chastity. And modesty is something that both men and women should have, right? Maybe women should have it more because men's brains are in their eyes. But they're visual creatures. Men are visual creatures. And also because...
Yeah, that is very true.
Yeah, men are visual creatures.
Yeah, that's their psychology.
Yeah, it's... It's in
their nature, right? And when you're like reading the Quran, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is directing men and women to observe, you know, chastity of the eye, it says, وَقُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ يَغُضُّوا مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِمْ. First, so tell the believing men to lower down their gaze when they're looking at non-mahrams. And then it directs or addresses Muslim women saying that,
وَقُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ,
right? Tell the believing women to lower down their gaze. Mm. So women are more...
Show-offy,
and they're like more, they are... manipulated, or they are influenced through their words and ears and sayings of
promises.
Words of promises of men. Mm. And men are so smart, those of them who know their way, you know, to influence girls and women, that they know how to sweet talk to women and how to like... To sweep them off their feet and to convince them that they're going to be their source of happiness in life, and they're going to, you know, so that they would choose them.
Mm. Because and a lot of women do the same, right?
Exactly.
And at the end, well, if y'all had modesty, y'all wouldn't have resorted to these methods and would have been able to cherish each other for, you know, who you really are.
Yeah.
You'd be valuable people.
Exactly.
That's what hijab is.
And there are so many ahadith that talks to men especially that if you're choosing a wife for your future, choose someone not based on their wealth or their beauty, their appearance, because their wealth might disappear or she might not even be, you know, willing to use it for you.
Yeah, because she doesn't have to.
Yeah, she doesn't have to. And her beauty might vanish in your eyes. Mm. Either vanish through
age
or she's still so beautiful, but you don't see her beautiful anymore.
Because she's so bitter.
Exactly. So because like you haven't taken into consideration standards or like real true
criteria
for marriage when you were on this, you know, verge of choosing a spouse. Mm. And the only criteria was how beautiful she is and how rich she is, like how rich her dad is.
That fades,
right?
That fades in a heartbeat.
And so, Zainab, this is, I'm not talking about fairy tales. I'm not like talking about movies. I'm talking about like real, this day, young men who, as their criterion for marriage, they have the beauty, like they say, she has to be tall, she has to have this kind of skin, she has to have this type of body shape, and her father has to be...
It just shows what kind of men they are.
Yeah, it does, but it shows...
I mean, it just shows that they have so little to bring to the table that that's all they pursue.
Yeah, it shows how surface-minded they
exactly.
are.
Exactly, they're so shallow.
Yeah, and
I think it's a he problem more than a she problem.
No, actually, the girls have the same problem.
Well, yeah, definitely.
What's his car? Where's his house?
That's biology, though. Yeah, wow. I'm here. I mean, I am not an expert, but for women to look for the financials, because women, they date, at a loss for a better word. They pursue mates based on a hierarchy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they pursue it across up, right? Because it's part of their biology to seek out someone that can financially support them and their offspring,
mm-hmm.
right? On the other hand, it is also part of men's biology to pursue women based on their appearance because that's the genetics that will carry on to their kids. This is all scientific.
But. And we're talking about the hijab.
But since we're talking about the hijab and the fact that hijab stems from an essential ideology, we have to look beyond the biological criteria and seek someone who possesses a value that will last. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sure, financial support is awesome,
mm-hmm.
but what does it matter if he has no akhlaq?
Exactly.
Sure, beauty is like a real treat on the eyes, but what does it matter if she raises absolute brats for you?
Exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady here on IRB English Radio. We'll be back after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
The beautiful verse says, "Wankihu al-ayama minkum." Marry off those single people around you, and don't worry. In yakunu fuqara yughnihimu Allahu min fadlih.
Beautiful.
If you are poor, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will enrich you
beautiful.
Out of his grace. Zainab, this is so beautiful. Yes. So if this woman, a lot of these girls, or even men, are not willing to marry, like, because of financial reasons, the guy says, oh, I'm not ready because I don't have a car, I don't have a house, I don't have a stable job. But the lady says, I'm not going to marry this guy because he's not financially, you know, well off. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that if this is the criterion for you, you know, have the right criterion in mind. And then
he'll provide the rest.
I guarantee you, if
beautiful.
I'm your sustainer, I will give it to you. Don't worry about it.
Yep.
This is beautiful. So scientifically speaking, or maybe worldly speaking, only taking into consideration the calculations,
matters.
The equations, material equations, you're right. You have to keep, you know, all the consequences into your mind. That's why when I was reading an article a couple of years ago, it was actually providing statistics of exactly how many dollars you have to invest on a child from the time that the child is born until the age
it
of 18.
It costs almost a mil.
Back then it was like some couple of $1,000s. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm saying that people are looking at it so materialistically. So this is this problem solved. The other one that sometimes if you really have the right intention and if you have a pure heart and you have your self-built person, you know, sometimes you see someone, they're not beautiful. Okay. But you are driven to them so much that you fall for them. That you say,
oh,
subhanAllah,
yeah.
This person is so strong, you know.
In character.
They have such a beautiful character. So
how's this related to the hijab?
The thing is that if people are, a lot of girls remove their hijab because they say, we want to get married and I want to show all my beauty to my suitors, to the guys around me so that they would consider me as a beautiful woman.
They want to increase their options.
Exactly. So
it's not going to work that way, though. Because by removing your hijab, you're just going to make yourself available for the wrong kind of guys.
Exactly. And maybe someone who you think who's rich and who is so charming comes and proposes to you and you get married, but then because of his, as you said, lack of akhlaq or faith, he's not going to be loyal to you. He's, even if he's going to be loyal to you, he's going to treat you in such a terrible way that you would wish you would get out of this relationship at every moment of your life. Mm-hmm. He's going to make life hell for you. And again, there's this beautiful hadith that the Imam says, if you're looking for a husband for your daughter, choose someone that, you know, he's pious. Because if he likes her, he's going to love her. He's going to do everything
cherish
for her.
He's
going to cherish her. And even if he doesn't love her, he's still going to respect her because he fears from God.
That is so profound.
So beautiful, right? So those girls out there, if hijab is a concern for you, that you want to, you know, put it aside to have more options available on the table, it's really not worth
it. Yeah, they're barking up the wrong tree at this point because they haven't gotten their priorities straight, you know?
Right.
And I mean, sure, if they're looking for that sort of guy mm-hmm. who values an immodest woman, then by all means, go for it, you right. know? And you're just going to meet the consequences of that, of mm-hmm. your choices, because that's what life is. But if you really, at the end of the day, or at the back of your head, somewhere deep down in your shadow persona, you still value a dude that fears God and believes in the afterlife, wants to have spiritual growth with you, yeah, at least stay modest, man. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes, well, actually, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, and we have so little time. One of the biggest reasons why some of the women are steering away from hijab is because we force upon them hijab without instilling in them haya.
Mm.
You know? We're like, oh, put on the hijab, cover your hair, don't go out of the house with makeup. What is that tight clothes? But, you know, we've constricted their minds to clothing, and that's all they think religion is about.
Mm.
We haven't planted the seed of that value we think the hijab represents in their very souls. And then we expect them to, you know, blossom out with a hijab. Like, it doesn't work that way. They're not mushrooms.
There's so much more to talk about hijab. Like, one of the things that we can mention is these days, a lot of people, not just these days, it's been a couple of decades since the appearance of Muslim feminists, that they're saying that hijab is nowhere mentioned in the Quran. And there are some verses that do mention the word hijab, but it doesn't really bound women to observe the hijab. It has a story of this and that, whatever. So we can talk about that some other sessions. And one other point that I wanted to make today was that one very strong urge, it's not just enough to provide reasons for the girls why they have to wear the hijab, because if they are raised, if the father or the mother brings all kinds of logical reasons as to why you have to wear the hijab, but then the relationship between the husband and the wife, the mother and the dad, the parents, is so chaotic that they say, oh, you're talking about Islam? You're talking about like preserving values? Huh? Excuse me, but back off. Because if this is the religion that you're talking about, I don't want it. I'll kiss it goodbye. So this will have to be one point that parents will have to really, really pay attention to if they want their girls to be really hijabi.
It was the topic of hijab, the importance of understanding the essence of hijab, and a value to fight for, to wake up for in the morning, and to strive toward. Until another episode, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting. for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's wrong policies have caused many immigrants to be harassed and tortured at the American borders and even spend a long time in detention centers. Many analysts believe that Joe Biden is doing the same wrong Trump's policies against immigrants. These policies have put the lives of many immigrants in danger, and even human rights groups have reacted to U.S. President's immigration policies. In this regard, we have taken a look at some of the world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Stay tuned, please. The Truth Out website explains more about the wrong immigration policies by the U.S. administration, saying hopes for abolishing one of U.S. most harmful immigration policies, including deportation following incarceration in the criminal legal system or double punishment, are withering as the Biden administration continues to snub immigration reform. According to a recent Syracuse University report, 3,481 immigrants are currently in removal proceedings because of criminal charges, and many of them were seized upon their release from prison before they could take even a single breath in freedom. And while that number is on track to be less than last year, advocates warn that without changing the underlying laws, rules, and policies, what goes down this reporting period can go up in the next. Heidi Altman, Director of Policy for the National Immigrant Justice Center, NIJC, told Truthout, "The numbers are still astronomical in terms of sheer numbers of people deported from their loved ones after a conviction or arrest," adding, "There are many ways this could be done even without congressional action through reversal of harmful Board of Immigration Appeals precedent, through rulemaking to allow greater access to bond hearings for those detained on the basis of criminal convictions, through processes to allow those unjustly deported to be returned, and or through policy memos and training that requires officers to consider the racial bias inherent in the criminal legal system when making detention and deportation decisions. But none of that has happened. instead of being returned to their families and communities for re-entry to society, they are often held 6 months or more in private for-profit detention facilities and then deported to countries where they may not have lived for decades, know no one, and do not speak the language. WTTW Channel 11 is a PBS member television station in Chicago, Illinois. The TV channel's website has published an article concerning this issue, saying the U.S. Supreme Court has certified its ruling allowing the Biden administration to end the Migrant Protection Protocol's policy, better known as Remain in Mexico. The policy was a part of former President Donald Trump's border policy, forcing migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. to wait in Mexico for hearings. In June, a Supreme Court decision overruled a lower court that forced the policy to be reinstated in December. But while President Joe Biden previously tried to end the policy, there has been little comment thus far on when his administration might officially follow through. Gladys Molina Alt, executive director of the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, said she has spent time along the U.S.-Mexico border and the situation remains very difficult for the migrants in limbo. Molina Alt said, "What I have seen on the ground is families, parents, we talked about having to make a difficult decision on whether they remain in Mexico waiting for their cases to be processed or make that difficult decision to have their kids across the border by themselves while they remain in Mexico. So family unity is something that we've seen be an issue at stake on the ground." She said, "We've also heard both who are in these MMPP camps talk about the security issues that they face, the kidnapping that happens, the rapes that happened, the violations of human rights for them as migrants in Mexico that take place." In addition to criticisms from the human rights organizations of the Joe Biden administration in continuing Donald Trump's wrong policies toward immigrants, some American officials have also criticized Biden administration's wrong policies toward immigrants. According to a New York Post report, the chief of the U.S. Border Patrol blamed President Biden's wrong immigration policies for sparking the surge of illegal immigrants crossing into the U.S. Raul Ortiz made the frank admission that the administration's wrong policies are to blame in a recorded deposition that is part of a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security by Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody. TheWhistleblower.org says, while many public health experts urge the Biden administration to end the use of Title 42 in immigration cases, it remained government policy to do so until April, when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, finally announced its termination. But just days before the CDC order was to take effect on May 23rd, a Trump-appointed general judge in Louisiana blocked the lifting of Title 42, claiming it violated administrative law and would cause irreparable harm. Yet opposition to the lifting of Title 42 isn't solely coming from Trump appointees and Republicans. For example, the Public Health and Border Security Act, which would require all COVID-19-related national states of emergency to be lifted before Title 42 is officially terminated, was introduced in April by Senators James Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma, and Kristen Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, along with nine other senators, including Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia. Dawn Wooten, a single mother of five, used to work as a full-time nurse at the Irvin County Detention Center in Osceola, Georgia, which was operated by the private contractor LaSalle Corrections. Though she was not officially terminated by her employer, she wasn't called back to work after she began speaking out about unimaginable atrocities being committed against immigrant detainees there. Wooten shared disturbing accounts of medical misconduct at the center, including the refusal by authorities to screen detainees for COVID-19 and the destruction of medical records. Unfortunately, these types of abuses at detention facilities aren't isolated incidents. According to Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CRU, and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU of Florida, the Glades County Detention Center in Moorhaven, Florida, has a history of radicalized violence, sexually abusive behavior, medical neglect, and inhuman treatment of immigrants. CRU and the ACLU of Florida filed a federal lawsuit in April against ICE and the National Archives and Records Administration, accusing Glades officials of deleting surveillance videos that could verify claims of abuse by detainees. The Truth Out website wrote in June 2021, Illinois passed laws that banned police from assisting ICE in making arrests and ended private civil detention facilities in the state. Following its lead, other states are starting to move legislation to protect their immigrant communities from double punishment. Most notably, the California legislature is considering the Vision Act, and advocates far and wide are excited that its potential passage in a populous and politically important state could lead other states to close the prison to deportation pipeline and further decriminalize immigration. The Vision Act would prohibit collaboration with ICE to remove people who are being released from prison to jail. Under it, immigration status will no longer be used as a determining factor in how people are treated by state and local agencies and its courts. It would also abolish certain discriminatory record-keeping and reporting requirements. According to the latest published statistics, U.S. authorities arrested more than 221,000 people at the Mexican border in May alone, which is the highest number in 1 month in more than two decades. Experts have cited extreme poverty, rampant violence, and natural disasters caused by climate change in Latin America, especially in the countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, and Honduras, for the rampant increase of immigrants to the American borders.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.